could you give us a thumbnail sketch of your training and your lead up to being a prisoner of war?
I'll try. At the outbreak of war, I was training at the College of Aeronautical Engineering, Sydney Street, London. They also had the base there at Brooklyn's Aerodrome. I was just about finished my time at the college when war broke out. Had war not broken out, I would have probably gone on to civil aviation and got my ground engineer's licenses. But with the outbreak of war, that put paid to that. So there wasn't much one could do. So I kicked my heels for a little while and decided anything to do was join the Air Force. I got part qualifications. So we did a quick trip to the local recruiting station, Dunfermline. This is in Essex. From there, they said, oh, well, go home, we'll call you when we want you. About a fortnight, I was called to Uxbridge, which was the number one recruiting station. There, they tested you, did a medical, checked you for trade, and then sent you home again. I got sent home because I think they got the wrong, something happened anyway. Anyway, I went home again, and they called me back again. And they said, oh, Romford must have made a mistake. I said, well, that's what they said about you. So I wanted to be an engine fitter, and they had me down as an instrument bearer. I didn't want to do instrument repair. Anyway, I got my way, came with 52E engines. But from Uxbridge, we got posted to Northcotes to 3 feet of snow. We were supposed to do our swear bashing. Nothing was done there. Then we finally got posted back to Poulton, which was a pre-war camp. Very, very good, excellent conditions. And there we started training as engine fitters and frame fitters and so on and so forth. From there, we suddenly got posted up to Hennesford on Cannock Chase. It was all dusty roads and wooden huts. And the standard of training in the whole course went down from AC1 down to minus AC2. It was really a lousy camp. Anyway, at the end of the course, we were all grouped up to be posted overseas. People I was supposed to go overseas with had absolutely nothing in common with them at all. I couldn't stand the sight of them. I don't think they liked me very much. Fortunately, for some reason, I failed the course. So I didn't go overseas after all. And I finally got posted to Hemingsville in Lincolnshire to serve at Hamlin's. I was an aircraft in second class then. As a mechanic. I worked there for about 9 months, I think it was. They sent me on a conversion course from mechanic to fitter. I had 6 weeks at Hennesford again, and back, fortunately, to my own squadron, 144 at Hemsville, which was very good. Finally, we went from Hemsville to North Luffenham, smallest county in England, in Rutland, and I was there for about another 9 months. It was very good servicing Hamdens, a lot of fun. Then I decided it was about time I did something else, and I applied for posting to a flight engineer's course. Finally, that came through, and I went for an interview to Cardington, where they had the airships before the war. And went down to Cardington, three or four of us, had an interview there. And we were sent back after that to North Luffenham, found the whole squadron had scarpered. They'd gone off to Scotland to do torpedo bombing for the coastal command. And we were left there not knowing quite what was going to happen. It was a Polish squadron that had taken over. Their food was much better than ours. And finally, we got sent to Syston, just outside Nottingham, with 61 Squadron. And that was a conversion flight from Manchester's to Lancaster's. And I serviced Manchester's for about 3 or 4 months there, dreadful things. And a little bit on Lancaster's, not much. And then finally, the posting came through to go to Flight Engineers Course down at St Athens in South Wales. We did 6 weeks down there. We were expected to do the course, night guard duties, and concentrate on the course. You can imagine what happened to the instructors on the course. They're all asleep during the day, so what the hell? Anyway, we finally passed out of them there, and I got posted with another bloke to Eastmoor, to the 158 Squadron, and revenge crewed up with a crew. I went with another crew and pilot. It's all in my little book over there. We got crewed up. We did a few night cross countries. And
what aircraft was this?
This one, Halifax, the early Halifax. We got to Eastmoor, flying Halifaxes. What disappointed me was the fact that when I got to Eastmoor, I found the Halifaxes there had Merlin engines. The original Halifax came out with radial engines, and the one we were shown at St Athens had radial engines. And so when I got up there, I found most all my engineering experience on the Air Force had been on radials. So I was lost. Well, we were lost. Anyway, that's beside the point. But we did a few cross-country trips, and we were given one plane which we were told was the newest plane on the squadron. But I wasn't too sure about that, because when you got in, you had to pump the old hydraulic oil up for an engine before you could start up. And all the newer ones that we flew in after that, we didn't have to bother with it. We did one trip with a pilot, a night flying test, I think it was, and we took off, and we were halfway down the runway, and the pilot said, look at the airspeed. The airspeed was going down. It should have been going up. We were too far to stop, so we had to carry on. So we took off, and we flew around, sort of remembering that this thing was all upside down. We flew around for a bit and then we asked for permission to land, and they gave us that, and then they gave us a red light on top of that. So we went round again and finally decided we'd land on our own. We landed on our own, got down onto the runway, and we ran off the runway at one end, and all we broke was a little strut in the tail. The pilot became flight sergeant after that. Gave us a lot of faith in him as a pilot. Then we did two or three more trips, went to Paris and paper with leaflets, and then we went to Düsseldorf. That seemed to be all right. And then we went to Bremen, and on the way back from Bremen, the pilot said, look at the engine temperature, and it was actually going up and up and up, and the revs were going up and up. So we cut the petrol off, and we did what we could. Tried to feather the prop, nothing seemed to happen. The whole thing was going away, they're waving away, and we were just going round in decreasing circles like this all the time. So there was nothing much we could do, so we thought we'd better bail out. So we bailed out to the River Holland. I think we must have been about 14,000 or 15,000 feet up. Seemed to be plenty of time anyway. And finally, we got rid of the rest of the crew, except the pilot and myself. Thought that might help, but it didn't. So he said, you'd better go. But every time we took the foot off the controls, the plane went into a power dive. So I left him to it, and he must have got out. But anyhow, I didn't know at the time, and I was floating over it when it crashed and blew up. I have got a photograph of the house near where it crashed. A little later on, I got picked up. I landed in a ditch in Holland in water. Some Dutch people came along and picked me up. They took me to what they said was a pumping station, which has since been converted to a house that people live in. They took me along there, and then eventually people gathered. I didn't understand French or German very much. I sort of gathered that if I had been able to speak French or German, I might not have been a POW. You couldn't risk it. My knowledge was nil. Anyhow, we finally got picked up by the Dutch police. Have a photograph of him too. I took it to the police station, searched me. I had about three knives on me for various reasons, you know. And then finally the Germans turned up, an officer in a car, and he was sitting in the back seat with my pilot. So we were sitting in the back together. What the confusion to the Germans was the fact that two planes had come down that night. There was another one that came down a few kilometres from where we were. It was a Lancaster. And that crashed, but unfortunately they blew up. They had a full bombard on. They were off course. I've got a full story of that at home. We drove around for a bit looking for other members of the crew. I finished up in the end at Leeuwarden, which was a German Air Force base. We were treated quite well there with the Luftwaffe. We fed in the officer's mess and generally looked after quite well. And finally we got taken off to Amsterdam across the Zuiderzee. It's not called the Zuiderzee, that's something else. And we were taken across there to Amsterdam. We spent about 4 or 5 days in a civilian prison there in separate cells. We could talk to each other through the bars. It was quite good. Well, I mean, outside, if you wanted to go to the toilet, you'd get the guard, and he'd take you down the stairs to outside into the yard where the toilets were. So you couldn't do anything much there. And finally, they gathered us all together, put us on a train, took us to Düsseldorf, which is the main place they took all the Air Force for interrogation. I don't really remember much about that, but I seem to remember marching from the railway station to camp, and there were lots of civilians around all looking at us. And there was one little boy, he was all about this high person. He was the Hitler Youth exercise, and he was screaming his head off. Couldn't understand the word he said, but we'd get the general idea. But he could only be about 14, 15, if that. Anyhow, we got to the camp, so I don't remember much about the camp at all. Ship just seemed very comfortable for what it was. And then after they got a full camp, we were shipped onto a train, a full train of, I don't know how many there were in the camp actually, but we were fortunately in carriages, not in cattle trucks at that time. This was in 1942. So we were quite well off as far as that went. But we had about 6 to a compartment, and we went up the Rhine Valley. But you couldn't see much because all the blinds were drawn down. We were sort of a bit cramped there, but if you imagine a full train of airmen and whatever else, plus masses of guards, armed to the hilt, Tommy guns, rifles, hand grenades, the whole blooming lot, you know. And what they thought we could do, I don't know. But you can imagine after 5 or 6 days on the train what the toilets were like. Finally, we finished up at Lambsdorff, and we had a very dusty, hot march in September from the railway station to the actual camp. There, we were taken and given a medical of German doctors, fingerprinted, given a metal tag with our POW number, MAMA 27003. And then we were put into the Air Force compound, which was in the middle of the camp. The reasons being that we'd had various people who tried to break out. One of them, I believe, was Douglas Bader, who gave them hell and tried to break out there, minus his legs. So they shifted him, and they put us into an inside compound. And you can imagine going into a long wooden hut, low, standing on a porch, looking down it. about 120 blokes there in various states of dress and undress, some with beards, some without, and smoke and washing hanging on lines above the ceiling, and wooden bunks on one side and tables and forms on the other. It was pretty ghastly. You wonder, how the hell am I going to put up with this? But you got used to it after a bit. But we had about 5 or 6 weeks, I think it was, before an order came through that we were to be tied up. So we were tied up with string. Something the army did to the German prisoners, or the Canadians, I think, did to the German prisoners they picked up at the airport somewhere. They tied them up, apparently. So they thought, right, well, the chariot on the British prisoners of war and the Canadians tied them up with string. So we tied up with string like this from 7 in the morning till 6 o'clock at night. And they were undone at 10:30 till about 11:30, so the suit could come up in the kitchen. And they tied us up again. But you think of the number of guards and people we kept occupied doing that, because they not only had their rifles and tie guns and hand grenades and everything else with them, and they had about 8 or 9 to each hut. What the hell they thought we could do, I don't know, and we were tied up like this. Anyway, they finally got fed up with the string, and they finished up with chains about this much apart. And they had little padlocks on them, but all different keys. So you can imagine in the morning when they came in to chain you up, they had to go through all the keys to get the things locked. And then at night when they came back to undo you, they had to find all the keys for the different padlocks. It was wonderful. It kept them going for ages. Then they got tired of that.
How long would this go on for?
It went on for about 9 months altogether. They finished up with handcuffs, which, you know, they clip on handcuffs. You could use those. And that was fine, because you could undo those. If you had a nail or another file, you could undo them. But if you got caught without them on, that was a problem. But we went over the handcuffs. They weren't so bad. You could do something with them. But finally, they gave up the whole exercise.
And when were you released?
From the chains?
Yes.
It must have been about 9 months after. We got October, I think, we were tied up. About 9 months after that, I think it was. We had that time. So you can imagine what you were like. Not much strength there at all. But we had some very good PT people there, and they helped us out and did exercise and things. Got us more or less better.
You really had a bad time.
Well, I don't know. A lot of it depended on the camp and the people you were with and the way it ran. We were pretty lucky where we were. They did get a bit tight one time. The cooking was done on tin stoves made out of Red Cross tins. And one day we had an inspection by the German officers. They used to come round and they saw this tin stove there, which was smoking away quite nicely. So he put his boot into it and smashed the whole thing up. Really. A few weeks later, another officer came through and there was another little fire purposely lit for them. And they were smoking away quite merrily too. And the officer put his boot into it, but he'd been lined with brick. He never had any more trouble.
So when were you finally released?
Well, that was in January of 45. That was when we were given 2 hours notice in January of 1945 to be ready to march.
And where did you march to?
We left Lambsdorff 12 o'clock. They had us outside the camp lined up. They gave us 2 Red Cross parcels apiece, £20 in weight, plus your own gear. So you can imagine what happened. You had to shovel out everything that you couldn't think you could carry, because it was 3 feet of snow on the ground at that time. You couldn't carry that much, not after 2 or 3 years in there. So we had to dump what we could, and we took tea and coffee and chocolate as good trading pieces with the civilians. And we finally left the camp about 6 o'clock at night in the dark with the snow about, and we marched from there. The idea was to get us away from the Russians. So we marched for 10 days, stopping mostly during the day and marching at night. We finished up at Gorlitz, which was another prison camp. I can't give you the number out of my head, but I have got the number. And we were there for a few days. It was pretty drastic there. There was no room for anybody anywhere. So they said, well, just sleep where you can get a bed. And two of us got in with a whole bunch of New Zealanders. And they really couldn't have done enough for us. Absolutely amazing. They dug up bedboards and somewhere to boil the copper, to give us a hot shower and everything else. And they really looked after us, and it was great. And then we thought we would stay there for a bit. They finally shifted us again across country, just wandering along with us. They had mostly the Volksturm, the People's Home Guard type of thing, looking after us then. And we watched until us jumped the column. We got fed up with it. So we left the column when we thought it was a good idea. And we stayed one night with the farm, where they slept us in their loft. And then we went on the next day on our own, just wandering around, you know. Unfortunately, we made a big mistake. We found a farm, and instead of giving the mess, we went in. It was still held by the Germans with a French working party. We should have known, because of the mess outside the camp. All the Red Cross tins were left, you know, from prisons that passed through. Anyhow, we stayed with them for a few days, and then they gave us one German soldier to take us cross country to another camp. So we marched across this open country, and I didn't hear it crash, but there was a hell of a roar above, and it must have been the fortress that was coming down to crash, because we picked up one of the crew from there, and we tried our best to get him to give us some chocolate or whatever he may have. He wouldn't have a word to do with it. When they got him finally into the camp, I don't know what happened there to him. But we were lucky there. The German officer came into the hut and said to the guard, "What are these people doing here?" He said, "Oh, I picked up the American on the way." He said, "Well, you should have shot them." He said, "I couldn't. I had these two with me, my friend and myself." He said, "Well, I'll take them outside and I'll do it myself." But he hesitated. And another officer came out. The officer said, "What are you doing? They're old and registered prisoners. You can't touch them." So we got away with it. And then we finally went into the camp for a bit. Finally got into the main camp. But the worst camp I've ever been. The only time I ever got lice. It was terrible.